You are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Title of our session here, War and Peace. Normally we think of these as opposites, and of course it's nicer to have peace than to have war. As I was interpreting it in the early session, we can relate to this sign here in front of us. The center is the place of peace. And the cycle is the place of war. When you have a cycle, something is ending and something is beginning all the time. That's the nature of it. That's the nature of life. And so there are many philosophers who recognize peace as a form of war. There are forces. You're eating, you're killing other animals, you just don't pay attention to that. But from the standpoint of chickens and turkeys, this is pretty serious. And we take the whole thing in terms of our own position. But life in time is what is meant in the large sense by war. And war is simply a crisis situation of time. Time is the field of sin, of war, of beginning, of bliss, and the whole darn thing. The center is the realm of peace. Now, in your own psyche, in your own psychology, you must have a place where you know that's the immovable spot, this is the realm of shanti, shanti, shanti. Then you move in the field of time, and how can you move in the field of time and still have the center of peace? This is what is known as karma yoga, maintaining the still point. Yoga is from a root yug that has to do with yoking one thing to another, yoking your daily consciousness to the source of consciousness, which is timeless, eternal, and supports all the field of change. The way of karma yoga then is action, performing what life dictates to you as being the action of your life without fear or desire for the result. It's not an easy thing, but that is how you maintain the place of peace in the field of war. That was, for me, the sense of what we were doing this week, to realize that the term war and peace meant life and the still point in the middle of the field. And there it is. When I was in India, I was there for about 7 months, and I wanted to meet and talk to a master guru. I didn't want a guru, I wanted to talk to someone who was recognized as a master guru. And I didn't want any more of this, all is Maya, because I'd had a belly full of that for 30 years. And I learned of a guru in Trivandrum in southwest India, to whom people came from all over the world. And his name was Sri Krishna Menon. And his saint's name was Atmananda, the rapture of the spirit. So I thought, well, I'll go down, and if I'm to see him, I'll get to see him. And so I went to this funny little hotel, the Mascot Hotel. And at dinner, my first evening there, I heard at the table beside me two gentlemen talking, and one mentioned the name of a young American poet whom I knew, Arthur Gregor. And I said, is Arthur Gregor here? Pardon me, I hear you mention his name. They said, yes, he's with Sri Krishna Menon. Well, I said, would you just please bring him my regards, Joseph Campbell. So next day I was invited to have a session with Krishna Menon. And, you know, if you're on the beam, the door is open, there's no doubt about it. And well, it was a 1 hour conversation with the man, and I was invited up to the attic where he was sitting in this naked attic, and there were two chairs. He was in one and the other was facing him, and I was invited to sit down, and he said, do you have a question? Well, I asked him a question, and I learned later from my friends who were with him that he was quite excited about the conversation, because the question I asked, as my first, had been his first question to his guru. And the question was this. So I bring you the authority of a guru on this thing. I said, since all is Brahman, since the whole world is a revelation of the immortal spirit, what right have we to say no to sin, to brutality, to stupidity, to all of these things that we regard as negatives? And he said, for you and me, the way is to say yes to it all. Absolute affirmation. That's the mystical position that I've assumed here. Stupidity, brutality, and all of this, these are manifestations of Brahman in the world. Now, on the ethical level, you may say no. But on the mystical level, you can't. Now, this is one of the big problems. You are to have your shanti on the metaphysical direction, and in the field of time, you can participate either in the black or the white of the pair of opposites. Make your choice. It's important and a very simple decision once you understand where the lines are and where the place of peace is. Well, he gave me what the Indians call a mantra. That is to say, something to think about as holding you on the track and putting you in touch with the realm of peace. And the question that you can ask yourself is, where am I between two thoughts? And there is a meditation on the breath where just at that split second between going out and coming back, you're neither in this movement nor in that movement, but are in the realm of peace. Yeah. Now, those things give you openings to a realm that is there all the time. Do you understand what I say? It's not only when you stop your breathing or stop your thinking that you get through, that you are in the realm of peace. It's only at that moment that you break through and come to know it. It's a little bit like what I've found in the way of scholarship. You're reading and reading and reading, and suddenly you find a scholar with an idea that you never heard of before. It seems like a wonderful idea. Where has it been all the time? Then you begin looking around in bibliographies, you find it's all over the place. It's been there all the time, only you just weren't reading the right books. It's the same thing here. The peace is in you, but you've been attached to the realm of the yin-yang, the interaction of the two negative and positives. But there's a place in you that is neither negative nor positive. An image that I like is that of a tennis match. If there's going to be a tennis match, you've got to be on one side of the net against the guy on the other side of the net, and he's against you. And there's no game unless you're trying to win. I mean, that's war. But there is a referee who doesn't care who wins. And he's just keeping score, and if he does care, he's not a good referee. And you must have that place in your mind even while you're playing tennis. You see, that's what's known as good sportsmanship. In the action, you are all the way. And behind the scenes, or even during the game, you are the referee. Well, now this is a problem also that one faces just in social associations. I have the experience, for instance, of being philosophically against the position of almost everybody I know. And I can't tolerate their position. And yet I have such feelings of charming personal relationship to these people who, on the battlefield, I would knock down. And this is the way to separate these two. You see, the friendship, that's the realm of peace. And there, the experience of the presence. But in terms of philosophical or political opinion and operation, I would just as soon knock that person galley west, you know? And if the person starts talking about those things, as they put himself in the field, I just have to go away. My wife takes me away. In fact, my last 10 years at Sarah Lawrence, I would not eat in the faculty dining room. I went downtown to eat. Every argument is a test. You're arguing along with friends, and then suddenly somebody says something that starts the sparks flying, and the whole thing gets into the battle. That's the passage from white to black there. And that's when my wife takes me away.
Well, in Buddhist imagery, the retreat to the experience is represented by the monk. The monk is wearing a yellow robe, and that yellow robe is the same yellow robe that is put on corpses to bring them to the funeral pyre. So the monk is dead to life. I mean, it's supposed he's really a monk. Got something else running around here nowadays. But that is the idea of the bodhisattva, the one who, having achieved the realization, nevertheless recognizes it as identical with participation in the battle of the world. And he does not wear a monk's garment at all. He wears the garment of a king, a crown, and he addresses the world. And insofar as we address the world voluntarily, knowing of its pain, and that we too will participate in the pain, because pain is the joy, and that's the funny part of it, we are then beyond the pair of opposites of nirvana and the world. The two are the same. And that's the great experience of the Mahayana. This is it. You have achieved illumination, and you look around, you say, well, that's what the world is. It is illumination. So that's the peace in the war. In the beginning, the first 500 years of Buddhism, from the time of the Buddha's life, 500 BC, until about the first century AD, it was essentially a monastic religion, the monks. And that's what you get when you read the Theravada, the doctrines of the old masters. But then in the first century AD, in northwest India, at the time of Vishanas there, Mahayana comes in. And in the Mahayana, they say, you don't retreat, this is it. And the peace is residing in the world. That's the meaning of that saying, Om Mani Padme Hum. The jewel of peace resides in the lotus of the world. That made it possible for Buddhism to go to China. And the vocabulary in China that was used to translate the Sanskrit was that of the Taoist texts. And then it goes to Japan, and it's still more positive in Japan. But they don't even have proper monks in Japan. The monks marry, you know. There's a wonderful saying in the Shinto text that I read, the processes of nature cannot be evil. Now this is just the opposite to the biblical Christian attitude, that the nature is fallen, nature is corrupt, it has to be corrected, and every natural, spontaneous act is sinful unless it has been either circumcised or baptized. sanctification of nature is through our religion. One way to get your mythology wrong is to think that it refers to facts. It never does. And as soon as the mythic image is thought of as reference to a fact, the religion has been wiped out in its spiritual aspect. It becomes then tribal again. For instance, the idea of the virgin birth had nothing to do with a biological anomaly, nor with anything that ever happened anywhere. It refers to the birth of the spiritual life in the human animal. That's the virgin birth, and one who teaches the spiritual life is said to have experienced the virgin birth, that is to say, at the level of the heart, the spiritual aims of life of which no animal has any knowledge have opened up. Otherwise, we're living as animals on the levels of the first three chakras. So, Christ rose from the dead, and the value of our religion lies in the fact that it was taught by one who physically rose from the dead and then ascended to heaven, which now nobody can find. Going at the speed of light, that body would not be out of the galaxy yet. The whole thing becomes a total absurdity when it's understood in those terms. And then there's business of the Exodus, which is so important to the Jewish tradition, how they suffered in Egypt, but Moses led them out through the waters of the Red Sea. So they're trying to explain it. Well, the wind was blowing from the north, and they went through the shallow spot. And so this is being translated into an actual thing that happened. Whether it was an Exodus or not, nobody knows, really. And nobody can date it within 400 years. So they got through the Red Sea, all right. But then what about when they get to the Jordan? And the Jordan backs up and the water piles up on either side and they go walking through these walls of the Jordan. It tells us this. It's in the Bible. It must be true, factually. And so always reading things as though they refer to historical events, it seems, well, we're pretty great because we come from people who walked across the river. Jesus walked on the water. Well, the Buddha did 500 years before. Nobody thinks the Buddha did it, but because they read things there spiritual. So we come to this thing that appears in Mark 13, that the world is going to end. And this is thought of as an actual coming event. Jesus said this event will take place before this generation has passed away. It didn't take place. So this is now known as the Great Non-Event. The church, however, insists on interpreting this thing historically. So it's a historically oriented mistake. The word generation meant generation of mankind. So at the end of the world, we're going to see the end of the world. A few years ago, there was a fellow in Ohio selling seats for the end of the world. And every 1,000 years, people think the end of the world is coming. We've got it now with the atom bombs. Okay, what that really is, if you want to use it for meditation, is not something to send you out on picket lines against atom bombs and things like that. It's simply an opportunity for you to think and meditate on dissolution. And who cares, you know? Without fear, everything ends, and maybe the world's going to end. Well, if that's not what the mystery of the end of the world is really referring to. So in the Thomas Gospel, which is the fifth gospel that was discovered in 1949, buried in the deserts of Egypt, Gospel according to Thomas, at the end of it, the disciples say to Jesus, "When will the kingdom come? When is the thing going to happen?" And Jesus says, "It will not come by expectation. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. It is here." So the end of the world means the end of an attitude toward the world on the part of someone who has had the aesthetic experience of the radiance within the forms of time. It all pans out the same way. It has to do with a plane of consciousness, a mode of consciousness. And so you can translate any religion of any importance at all has all the symbols in it. And they all make the same mistake of misreading the symbols as references to facts. And I like to say that my definition of mythology, as I popularly understood, is other people's religion. And my own private definition of religion is misunderstood mythology. And the misunderstanding consists precisely in interpreting the symbols as though they referred to persons or historical events. They don't. And they refer to possibilities within your own psyche of realization. And by meditating on these things properly, it excites your own Christ nature so that you become the Christ or the Buddha in realization. And that's what it's all about. If it's not about that, then what's the use? Now, with all this been meditating, some people have a hard time getting a point. Others don't have to work so hard. You can have instant illumination, or you can go through all kinds of exercises. The student who is trying to eliminate his ego comes to his master and says, "How am I doing?" And so again, there's that theme of shanti, or the peace, underlying the activities of the world. And when you are in peace, then with joy, joyful participation. I mean, what we're talking about here is really the bodhisattva attitude that peace and war are not different from each other. They're the same thing in two aspects. So I think that there's nothing negative to say about developing a bigger, stronger weapon. You see, what happened in the Orient was war was an aristocratic game. It really was. And it's a quite different thing when you are playing an aristocratic game from the kind of warfare that is initiated with mass armies, for instance, in the West with Napoleon. Look what happened when a new military formation was worked out by Alexander the Great. I mean, war required a whole new meaning in antiquity with Alexander the Great. Here was the Persian Empire where war was a kind of game. Alexander comes in as a youngster, and in a weekend he's knocked over the whole Persian Empire and moved right into India. It's a higher power in war. And it gives life that the culture that survives is the one with the weapons. Look what happened to the American civilizations of Mexico and Peru. 500 thugs with some horses and dogs came in and knocked down the civilizations. And the people let them in, thinking they were playing another kind of game. Think they wanted them, but they let them in. And then suddenly, bing! Now the curious thing there was that in both cases, there had been prophecies that the civilization was going to end, and Cortez comes in right on the path that Quetzalcoatl mythologically had left it on, and he was white, which is the color of the east, and he had guns, which was the thunder and lightning and everything else, so he was taken to be a deity. Maybe he was. No, I think you just have to let your ethics change with time and space.